Yes, Honest Actors is back with brand new episodes every Friday. To help me continue releasing new episodes without a sponsor, or to say thanks for your favourite old ones, click the support link in the episode description. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. It's a one-off, feeling generous, good deed for the day sort of thing. Think of it as bumping into me and buying me a drink. To find out more, click the support link. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, mine's a large red.
I hate those guys.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Let me tell you about my client, Michael Dorsey. He was a fine actor, but for every role he wanted, there was a reason why he wasn't right.
Sorry, you're too tall.
I can be shorter.
No,
I
can't use you. Too short.
Oh, I can be taller.
Too moody. Next.
Too old.
Too stubborn.
You're too much trouble.
Too tough.
Too temperamental.
Too pushy.
Too difficult.
Michael, no one will hire you.
Just watch me.
Boy, did he show us.
Hi, my name's Jonathan Harden, and you are listening to episode 7 of series 3 of the Honest Actors podcast, sponsored by TodayTix. If you want great offers on theatre tickets, access to day seats on your mobile, and exclusive front row lotteries, you need TodayTix, the ticketing app that lets you see theatre differently. To get tickets with no queues and no fuss, download TodayTix now from the App Store and Google Play. So here we are, Monday the 21st of January. It's been almost a month since the last episode of this series went out. If you weren't aware, I put out 6 episodes over 5 days at Christmas time. And to those of you who've already downloaded and listened to those, thank you very much. Thank you also for spreading the word. Please continue to do that on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, wherever it is that you spread your good news. If these podcasts have been enjoyable and potentially useful to you in some way, they might be useful and enjoyable to others in your life. So please do tell people. It's the only way that word gets out there. The podcast is on Twitter at Honest Actors. It's also at facebook.com/Honest Actors. You can leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts /iTunes. And the podcast is now available to be listened to on Spotify, as well as on the Acast app, Stitcher, and loads of other podcast apps. So wherever you listen to this podcast, if you can leave a rating and a review, please do so. And please do share and continue to share your favourite bits of the podcast using the hashtag Best of Honest Actors. I don't think I have anything else to ask of you except to reiterate that. Just share the shit out of the podcast, especially in January. It is no coincidence that I held off on releasing episodes that I had for quite some time until December. The podcast stats traditionally have gone through the roof in December and January because, surprise, surprise, lo and behold, it is the time of the year when actors tend to feel at their lowest, at their most helpless. And in spite of the fact of that New Year burst of energy that a lot of people seem to get, it's often short-lived. And by this point in January, people can start to feel like, you know, useless, permanently unemployed. Like, why hasn't my agent called me since before Christmas? All of that carry on. So if that's the way you're feeling, you can bet your bottom dollar that other people in your life who are actors are feeling the same. So not only share this podcast, but just give them a text, give them a call, meet up for a coffee, bitch about the world. You will feel better for it. Don't sit on your own thinking you're the only dickhead, right? You're not. So share the shit out of this. Go meet someone, have a chat, look after yourself. It will come good in the end. Anyway, this is episode 7 with Emily Berrington. Some of you may have already heard the special live episode with Emily Berrington and Sean Biggerstaff, which we did for Equity just before series 3 went out. If you haven't already listened to that, you should go back. It's really, really good. I'm not the person doing the interviewing. That's done by Larner Wallace Taylor, who also produced that special live episode for Equity. And I thought it was great. And I sat in the audience and thought, I have to get these two onto the podcast and do, you know, fuller interviews with the two of them. So this is the first one of those with Emily. I spoke to her over the phone from the cupboard in my bedroom to somewhere in her flat in London just before Christmas. And this is that interview. Enjoy. Emily Barrington. Got her number. And that's her phone ringing.
Hello.
Hello, is that Emily?
It is. How are you?
I'm not bad. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
So listen, just so you know, I'm recording this call for training and monitoring purposes.
Yes, of course.
I have to say that whenever we did the Equity chat, I was listening to both you and Sean and going, why have I not had these two on the podcast? They're both amazing. It was so good. It was so good listening to you two
as but
purely as audience as well. You know, like having somebody else, having Larner do the chat.
Yeah, that must have been weird that you got to just listen.
Yeah, it was kind of, it was totally bizarre, but great, because aside from the couple of moments when I got too much for me and I felt like I had to shout from the back of the theatre, you know, it was actually really nice just hearing that kind of conversation happen and also hear Larner take it somewhere slightly different as well, which was great. But no, I really genuinely enjoyed that chat. And but at the end of it, thought, God, I could have a extended chat with both these guys. And I'm sure there's more in both of them. So thanks.
I hope there
for,
is.
Well, if there's not,
I'll just repeat myself. If not, it's fine.
If there's not, I'm not going to tell you. So, but, you know, we'll just pretend at the end that it's been the greatest chat.
It was brand new information. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sure there's more. I really enjoyed it. It was lovely.
So what was that like for you? Because I guess the thing is, I very rarely get to chat to people about the interview after it's happened. And I guess this interview hasn't happened, but in a way, a little bit of it will have been had by you and Larner during the Equity chat. And I wondered how that felt, if that's a fair question. Like, do you come away with that, from that going, did I overshare? Did I, you know, did I say things that make me sound bad? Like, was there any panic after that? Or was it?
I always have a bit of a panic after any interview I've ever done, whether it's press related or this, which was very different and not about promoting anything or myself. And I think that it's because it's so deeply ingrained in you as an actor that your image is so important, and that the way you come across is really important, and kind of every word you say in an audition could like turn things one way or the other, that I definitely I no longer, for example, read any interviews that I've done, whereas to begin with I'd be really excited and like read back, and then would feel terrible afterwards and think that makes me sound like a moron or whatever. So I try not to overanalyze it. But
did you listen to that one?
I actually did, because a friend of mine who's part of Equity called me about it and was like, oh, it was so interesting and all this kind of stuff. And I think particularly because I was on with Sean, and I guess in the moment there's so much going on and so much information that I thought I'm going to listen back and see if what we said made sense and if it's stuff I stand by. And I think it's the classic
that you're thinking too much about what you're saying to listen to other people, truth be told.
Yeah, there were loads of things he said and I was like, oh, that was interesting, I hadn't heard that before. I was thinking all about my next cue, which is not good for acting. So I do think it's very, it's so hard when you're so in tune with how you're coming across as a person all the time to drop that and just go, the point of honest actors is to let down some of that guard and to try and get to what you actually think. But I don't think I just do it in interviews. I think I do it when I talk to people. I definitely do it in therapy sessions where I get to the end and think, I don't think I meant any of that. It was just what I thought I should be saying.
I was spilling silences.
Like, that was all a load of bullshit. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
I've only realized recently that one of my biggest personality flaws is that in the absence of an opinion, I'll just pick one at random and pretend like it's absolutely passionately held.
Absolutely. And then someone will disagree with me and I'll be like, why have I stuck myself to that stupid opinion?
Which is fine whenever it's why media training, I guess, is probably really good for people. It's really fine when you're talking about it behind closed doors. But then when someone's chatting to you for something and they ask you a question and you feel like, I can't just say I have no thoughts. I can't possibly admit to that.
Changeable person and maybe... And quite often people bring up things that I've said in a previous interview and I think, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that anymore. And you feel like you either have to kind of damn your past self or agree with your past self. You can't just be like, I don't know, I'm a complex human being and one day I think this and another day I think this. So it's tough. You want to be interesting as well. I think that the pressure to sound interesting and worth somebody listening to a podcast of you or whatever is, I think, the temptation to have an opinion where maybe you don't and maybe you should be giving the floor to someone that does have one and does know about it is, I've been trying to kind of learn that, certainly.
With reference to that past self, because there's my in for a segue, how about that? Let's pretend that chat didn't happen, and please do feel free to feel like you may be repeating yourself. Those people who haven't listened, this is one of those moments where I break the fourth wall. For those of you who haven't listened to that, you should go back and listen to it, because I think it is really genuinely worthwhile to hear Sean and Emily talking about the things that they discuss. And also, like I say, to hear a slightly different spin on similar questions from this podcast being delivered by a different interviewer. So it's worth having a go on a chat. But let's leave that in the past and let's go further back. And as I always do with everyone, I'm going to ask you how you came to be an actor. How did you get into this? What were your first steps towards acting as a profession?
I suppose doing lots of AmDram at school and in local societies. And then I went to university and did AmDram on the side of my degree. And then I went to do other work and other jobs. But I was still thinking about whether I could become an actor. And I just didn't know how it would be possible, and all I'd ever heard was how difficult it is and competitive. And so I'd kind of been a bit put off as to whether I would really enjoy it if I was part of the business of it. But then a close friend of mine went to drama school, and I just thought, oh, why am I not giving it a go? Why have I held myself back? And I was doing a job, I was working for the Labour Party, I was in the House of Commons, and I thought, I wouldn't have known 5 or 10 years ago how to get this job, but somehow I've got here.
Yeah.
So if I apply the same thing to being an actor, maybe I will work out if that's possible. And so I've kind of allowed myself.
That's pretty good logic.
I just thought I'll take it step by step, basically. It's what I really want to do. So I'll apply to drama school. And I did. And I went to Guildhall. And then at the end of Guildhall, I thought, I'll see what happens in third year. You know, I'll see if I get an agent or how you get an agent, and I'll see if I can get a job. And I've kind of tried to carry that on, but I try not to look 30 years ahead. I just sort of try and think about the next 6 months or a year or something.
Yeah, we should never think 30 years ahead. What comes of that?
Actors probably won't exist anymore.
Yeah, I know. We'll be CGI. You remember what your very first time on stage was, what age you were, and what was the particular context?
I was in it's good for this time of year. I was in my nursery nativity.
Lovely.
And I played the innkeeper's wife. And I was absolutely livid that the innkeeper's wife didn't get to say anything, but only the innkeeper got to speak.
I'm livid for you. I'm livid for you.
I know. It was very pre-era 50-50. And now I'd be demanding that I got to say half of the there's no room at the inn line. And there's a photo of me next to my innkeeper husband looking absolutely livid with kind of, like a little dressing gown on, I think.
I am not even livid about that. I'm livid that it's not even the lead role.
I know.
Don't they know who you're going to be? I mean, come on. What's Mary doing now?
No, Mary. Yeah.
Probably working in the Houses of Parliament like a loser.
Probably, yeah, like an absolute loser. I know. Do you know what, though? I don't think I'd have wanted to be Mary. I very much, all through school and everything, I never wanted to play a lead role in anything. It was like, I think I couldn't get my mind around having that much focus and attention on me. And there was What We Did Oliver at school. I remember crying myself to sleep one night because I thought they might make me play Nancy. Hilariously, they didn't. And I was in the chorus. So my ego got ahead of me there. But I was so worried that I might have to do something where there would be too much focus on me. So it sort of took a while before I got my mind around, you know, that was okay. And maybe even, you know, a positive thing, because it meant that you had a really interesting part. But it definitely wasn't a natural part. So The Innkeeper's Wife was kind of good for me in a way, but, you know, could have done with somewhere in the middle. Maybe the Angel Gabriel or something.
But what's interesting about that is, though, it speaks to kind of a larger, a thing that seems to be, that people seem to hold, which is that actors like the spotlight. Non-actors, people outside the industry, seem to think that actors are actors because, oh, you love the attention, right? You know, the classic of if a family event's happening, or, you know, at the other end of the scale, if there's a family funeral, the first person they think of to speak will be the actor in the family, because that means nothing to you. That is the easiest thing in the world to you. And quite often this podcast, it's turned out that actors actually are not necessarily the people who step forward and grab the microphone in other circumstances.
So no, for sure.
As a kid, were you a shy kid in the class, or were you?
Yeah, I guess I was kind of socially fairly confident, but I was very non-pushy. I would never kind of be the one that pushed to the front to do something. I was very happy kind of in an organizational role. I think I was PE kit monitor was my proudest moment when I was in primary school, that I was like, you know, I wasn't like class president, not that I think there was one when we were five, but I was happy in a sort of small administrative role.
Yeah.
And
you were a firm believer in the rule of law as well.
For sure.
That child is the child that ends up working in the Houses of Parliament, right?
No.
That child.
Yes, my creative side hadn't quite come out yet.
So how does that come about then? What's the transition from the kid who is PE kit? What is it? PE kit monitor? Is that
monitor?
Right.
Yeah.
So
I had to PE check
kit monitor is definitely on a trajectory towards working at the Houses of Parliament, right? So how does that kid become the kid that's on a trajectory to being a professional actor? Like, at what point does it start to swing where you think, actually, this is something beyond just a bit of fun? Is that much later, or is that something that you kind of, you keep to yourself and don't admit to others, but you feel it as a young child?
Well, no, I definitely didn't feel it as a young child. I was very happy with my PE kit monitoring, but by about the age of 16, 17, I'd left PE kits behind. And I think, I guess I did some AmDram in Oxford, where I grew up, at the Oxford Playhouse. And it was the first time I'd been on, you know, a professional stage at a professional theatre. And I remember there being something so special about that. And even things like, I really loved the tech and like the whole team of people that were there, and kind of all this effort that went into these really creating these really beautiful, amazing moments. And I think I began to enjoy the creative side of it before I began to feel comfortable with the attention and you know, the sort of self-analysis and so on that can go with it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, around the age of 16, 17, 18, I began to do more drama. I did some musicals at school and in this AmDram society. And it was through that I began to think, oh my God, can you imagine if this was your job? This would just be too brilliant.
Yeah.
But I guess I quelled it a bit and thought, no, I'll go to university and look at what else I could do, because I don't really know how I would turn this into a job. And it was doing plays and musicals at university that I found it very hard to stop thinking about how much I would like to do it. And it was definitely the part of my week I was looking forward to the most. And even though I loved other things, and I could definitely see that I could have other very happy careers, and I still totally believe that. You know, I'm never going to be somebody that says, like, I would die to be an actor, or there's nothing else I want to do, because there are loads of things I want to do, but the thing I want to do most right now is this. And I can feel a bit guilty for saying that, I guess, because it can sound a bit like you're not committed enough, or there are other people that want it more than you. But I guess I've always felt like wanting it isn't the thing that makes it happen, actually.
Yeah.
But if anything, sometimes the times I've wanted it the most have been the times it's been hardest.
So,
because the pressure's on so much.
So that 17 or 18 year old, how do you, before you quell it, before you put yourself off it or allow other people to put you off it, how do you find out more about it? Did you sit down and Google how to be an actor? Was it that level?
Yeah.
You didn't know anybody who'd done it. You'd know nobody in your family to go to, or did you get a little bit of advice from outside?
I had a cousin who's an actor, and still is an actor. And so I knew a little bit there. But I guess I just didn't know how I could do it. I think it felt like such a mystery journey that I do remember when I was maybe 18 looking at, when I was applying to university, looking at doing drama at university and then looking at going to drama. I'd sort of looked up a couple of drama schools, but I just couldn't tell from the internet what that meant and how you would know what a good one was or how you would then start working afterwards.
Yeah.
And because I also loved the idea of going to university and doing a degree, I was really into politics and geography and so on, so I did a geography degree. It wasn't even, in a way I quelled it, but in a way I was just torn. And because one option seemed so mysterious and I didn't know anybody who had taken that exact route, I just thought, I can't get my mind around it now. And it was at a time where university fees were £1,000 a year, I think, which is still a lot of money. But yeah, it's not. I wish there was another way of going about getting work, I suppose.
Buy tickets to the best theatre in London the new way. With the TodayTix app, getting great offers and access to exclusive tickets has never been easier. With TodayTix Rush, you don't have to queue at the box office for hours to get day seats like some insert insult here. You can access big savings with their lotteries for shows like, do I really have to open the app? I left my phone in the other room. You've been saved. Anyway, download TodayTix, the theatre ticket app, from the App Store and Google Play. And see theatre differently. I think I is then. Do you get anxious about the whole process of going in for a job?
I've tried very hard, particularly in the last year, to bring my stress levels down, whether that's kind of excitement or anxiety, because I was finding that particularly if it was a job I really wanted and a piece of work I really wanted to do, that I could wind myself up about it so much in advance, and also there's a never-ending amount of work that you could do, so I'd find myself up till kind of 2 a.m. working on something and then exhausted the next day, and that's not a very conducive way to work or a healthy way to live.
No.
That, you know, if it's a one-off, then that's okay. But if it's constantly how you get work, and the problem I was finding is that often it would pay off and the audition would go really well and I'd get the job. But I began to realize it was taking a bit of a toll on me emotionally, and I was getting more and more anxious. And then if I didn't get something, that it was so much harder. So I've tried to find ways of leveling out and setting myself rules of a time in the evening to stop working. And also, if I get something, not celebrating to the point of, you know, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me and it's going to change my life, but being reasonable and going, this is great, I'm going to really enjoy doing this and it's going to be really interesting, and then I'll be back here again in a few months' time doing another audition, so that if I don't get it, I don't have to fall down a complete well of despair, you know, to keep everything slightly more on a level plane.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible not to invest. If you really want something and you've worked really hard, then you're already invested in it. So you have to be realistic that you are going to feel things. And I certainly, from the moment I leave the audition to the moment I hear an answer, or don't hear an answer, as is often the case, I can easily just spend that whole time in an absolute, you know, state of dread and excitement, and convincing myself I got it, convincing myself I didn't, and calling my agent and saying, just checking that you haven't left me a voice message that I didn't hear. Yeah. Checking that my voicemail's working. And I've had to really kind of train myself to bring that down to a more livable with level.
So because you're seemingly on a journey of managing this shit and getting it under control, in the kind of worst case scenario, do you feel more anxious about an audition before or after?
Before, because I think before I still feel like it's all my responsibility and it's down to me how well it goes. And to a degree, that's completely true. But then there is a huge part of it that will only go as well as it can based on who's in the room, how they're feeling, what they're looking for. And so I think afterwards, I at least feel like it's in the lap of the gods now and I must do my best to move away from it.
Yeah.
So definitely beforehand, it's before where I really struggle to get myself to put down the script and go to bed.
And so when you don't get a job, it sounds like you don't necessarily blame yourself in the best version of events.
The best version of events, I don't. I feel like I'm realistic about the fact that it will just be that they didn't choose me, and they could have done, but they just didn't. And that's where the whole kind of obsessive hard working comes in, where you think, well, I could have done more, and I never want to leave myself feeling like that. But I think you tend to know if you do an audition and you'd prepared well enough and you were ready with ideas and choices and, you know, you gave it a good shot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough, isn't it, though? It's like,
oh, it is.
It really is. And it's really interesting hearing you, because one of the things I picked up on from the Equity chat was that you had very much changed how you approach this job over the course of your career. So from graduating and getting a good job in a theatre and getting good TV and, you know, like to use that phrase that, you know, you didn't like, but kind of high end or whatever it is, right? So working at that level, I guess you could almost fall into the trap of thinking that this is easy, or rather people looking at you from the outside could think she has it easy, that these things.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it would be false to pretend that that's not completely true, in that it does make it easier when you've done, even if it's just confidence wise, you know, you get a job and you think, okay, it's possible to get a job, so there's a chance I'll get another job. It doesn't, I think in terms of statistics, I certainly don't feel like it's magically easier, partly because the rooms you go into often get more competitive and you're going up for bigger parts where you're going up against much more experienced actors and that kind of thing. But yeah, I think it would be kind of a bit of a denial of the truth if I didn't say it does, some elements do get easier when you've done some of that work, but the pressure that you feel in terms of I'll never work again. Actually, I'm slightly contradicting myself there, but I think that you never lose the pressure that you feel of how much you want something, how much it means to you, the fact that you might have to deal with not getting it, the fact that there's a really, really good chance you're not going to get it because statistically it's unlikely to be you. That never goes away. And I know people who are working at a far kind of higher profile, I'm doing inverted commas, level than I am, that are far more stressed about their careers than friends I have who aren't at that level, but have found ways to make themselves very happy in their working life. And to take some of the pressure off themselves, kind of whatever it is they're auditioning for. So that's what I think you can accept that you're lucky to have done a certain amount of work and that will help you in some rooms and in some ways, but also know that there's a million more rooms that are just as terrifying as ever.
So when you get an email through and it says in subject line, Emily Barrington, you know, dash, and then the name of the project, dash.
Appointment notification, yes. Yeah, right.
And you read it, and the character is probably, you're looking at it, you think, oh, that's not anything anybody's ever asked me to do before or I've ever done before. Is there a point, even before you go into the room, where you start thinking, I'm never going to get this. This is...
Yes, of course. And I think that it's hard because you some things come through and you think, yeah, I this is something I've done before. I know I can do it. Great, I can smash this. But obviously the dream is, well, for me, is to get something that I haven't done before that is in a new direction. So I always feel that dual thing of when something comes in and yeah, I read it, and I think, oh, no one's going to see me as this. No, I'm really going to have to kind of fight to show that I can do this thing. A part of me is really excited because that's often what I want. But also it's hard not to go in. They're the auditions where whoever I see in the waiting room, I just think, oh, of course she's going to get it. She's absolutely perfect. I am a million miles away from what they're looking for. That girl is the dream. And so, I definitely get more wound up in terms of the lack of faith in myself to get it. Probably because you know that it is slightly harder to get things where people don't automatically think of you. But it has happened, and I have to hope it will happen again. And that some people are really open-minded and great at seeing that an actor is allowed to be loads of different things and not just one thing. Not just be a robot forever, for example. Yeah.
So there can't be too many of those parts. What I was going to ask was, I don't know if you've seen Tootsie. But there's a trailer for Tootsie, which is really worth looking at. And basically it's whenever he starts going for parts and the reasons why he's getting turned down. It's, you know, a load of panels and it's stuff like somebody going, too tall, way too short, doesn't look Jewish enough, too Jewish, right?
Yes.
And it's just a series of ridiculous and contradictory reasons why we don't get work. If such a thing existed for your career, have you ever had perennial feedback?
What's my montage?
Yeah, what's your
really good question?
What are the things that you feel like, oh God, not that again? I used to get, for example, too intense. Right. And as someone said to me,
what do you mean?
As someone said to me recently was exactly, the fuck are you looking at? Somebody said to me recently, no one says that to Daniel Day-Lewis. No one says, not that I'm saying I'm Daniel Day-Lewis, but no one goes.
No, but you're right.
But like, it's just that thing of like,
people love intensity from him. Why can't they love it from you?
Totally, right. And the thing is, I don't even think I'm intense, but that was really interesting. So that was kind of one of those things I used to get was, he's too intense. And I think, you know, I think that's partly down to people misreading Northern Irish accents as being slightly aggressive,
for
very obvious reasons. But
but not fair reasons.
So I'm wondering, is there anything over the course of, it may be something in the past that ceases to come in now? And of course, if you feel like, do you know what, I don't really want to answer that, it's quite a personal one.
No, that's really good. No, I'm really thinking about it. I'm trying to, because I feel like there's what you hear and then there's what you are assuming people think. I think definitely some feedback I used to have a lot and that I've really worked on was that I'd go in with this idea that I had to be so kind of pliable and amenable and ready to fit into whatever mold they were looking for, that I would go in without my own, well, I'd have my own ideas, but I wouldn't show them to anybody. I'd kind of do nothing. I remember my first audition ever was for a TV thing, and I just said the lines as kind of straightforwardly as possible with no thinking going on whatsoever.
Just be malleable.
Because I thought they'll just see whatever they want to see on me, and if I make a choice, then they might not be able to see the choice that they want.
In many ways, you were cutting your own path through the industry there. You were you were redefining the very profession itself.
I was going in as a blank canvas.
Amazing.
For them to paint on, except obviously they didn't want to because it just looked like I couldn't act. So that was some feedback I got early on of like, don't be afraid to go in with your own idea and to really sock it to them. And if they're the kind of person that will give feedback and will work with you, then they'll tell you if it's 100 miles away. Might just be glad to see an idea. You know, they might not know. And that has worked so much better inevitably for me that from that point, I was like, I have to, even if I don't, you know, because sometimes you audition for things and you haven't read the whole script. You've got one page that tells you nothing. You still have to create something and make a choice that perhaps is arbitrary. And so that's what I try and do now, which it definitely has stood me in good stead. So I think, yes, being too pliable and amenable and not strong enough with my own opinions was the issue early on.
Oh, do you know what? That's a real, it's like saying, what do other people say in you that you don't like, which is kind of hard.
Why shouldn't someone cast you?
You know what I mean, right? It's a hard question, so fair play for answering.
No, it is hard. But it's a really good question, because also that's reminded me of something that I'd actually forgotten about, where, yeah, sometimes you need to check back in with those things and go, am I still doing, if I know what my default kind of flaw is, then you can keep addressing it. Whereas, yeah, I'd kind of forgotten about that.
You mentioned in the equity chat that you are a big fan of chasing up on an answer of whether you've got a job or not. Is there a reason for that? Is that come out of a particular experience, or is it just a kind of growing sense of disappointment at not hearing back repeatedly?
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of everything, really. Some of it's just been a growing confidence in what I think actors deserve. And the more I understand about the industry, the more I look at that issue and think that's really outrageous that you drop everything, you do really hard work to go in and do an amazing audition, and you might never be told yes or no. And you also often have no idea of the time frame. So in 6 weeks' time, you could still be in the mix or you could not be. And in order
in the mix,
things that I went in for 5 years ago, I was fine.
I mean, what I want to know is I want to hear my brother, who goes in for a job in a software development kind of capacity. And when you say how it goes, he says, I'm in the mix. Like, that never happens in the real world.
Never.
Like, nobody says, well, they told me I'm in the mix.
And also, we have no idea when we'll know. And I think that's what, you know, I do respect that is often the case. They don't know when they'll know. And they've seen a lot of people. So I understand it's not kind of a simple issue. But particularly because I've done other jobs before, you know, whether it's waitressing or working for Labour Party or anything, I applied, I had an interview, I was told when I would know by, and then I would know. Obviously, this is slightly different, but I still think there's a point at which it would be so beneficial to actors' mental health to know, because some of the most challenging times, I guess, I've experienced is when I've weeks and weeks and weeks hung on and thought maybe I've still got it, and I've been told I'm still in the mix, and then you see a casting announcement online and you think, I wanted to hear through a professional line of communication. I wanted my agent to call me, you know, and obviously they would if they had the information, but
I
wanted them to get a call and say, really sorry. And I remember I did an audition for Mark Rylance once for a play he was directing, and I didn't get the part. But 2 weeks later, I got a handwritten note from him saying specific things that had been really good about my meeting, and a sorry that they weren't going to offer it to me. And I thought, if he's got time to write a handwritten note, you know, surely there's a way that the system could be altered and a kind of blanket email could be sent out 100%. Just saying your client didn't get it, or we haven't made a decision. Please let them know that we haven't made a decision. Or so I'm not.
We're not asking for that all the time, right?
But I think if you've got a recall, if you're kind of down to the last few, then it's really great if people can just let you know.
The thing I said before, though, which is quite interesting, and I think this is the thing we've also got to be ready for, is if this ever did come about, you could be waiting for weeks anyway, because I know I've been given jobs, you know, 3 months before a start, but I've equally been given jobs the day of the read through.
Absolutely. And where you went in for it months ago and you've written it off. So no, of course it's not a perfect thing.
And most and recently you've been called back in for something after 3 months of thinking, well, I didn't get that. And then you're like, I might have got it. Turns out I didn't get it, right? But that's not the point. The point is, like, they couldn't have told me no.
No, because there wasn't a no.
So it is a kind of a weird old, it's a weird old game. And then equally, people don't sign a contract, you know, don't sign a contract sometimes until they're two or 3 weeks into a job or after it's finished. And you're like, well, they're not going to, it all feels like.
Until they're on set.
The healthiest thing, I think, is for us to care less, but also for people to respect us a little bit more.
I know as well that I've spoken to some casting directors about it who've been really, like, lovely and honest about how one of the challenges they face is that they're often, you know, we get a script 24 hours in advance to go into a meeting, often because the casting director also got it like 36 hours in advance and is on a very squeezed time frame and is only being paid for like that week of work. So doing all the no's would like push them into another week of work that they're not being paid for. And so I do understand it's not, it almost needs to start at a much higher level of somebody budgeting for this being part of the process. That's never going to happen.
But I think the point is, like you say, if one person can write a handwritten letter, it means that at least everybody else can do is click a box on Spotlight that says this role is now filled, right?
And I think I think that actors should probably be given a bit more credit, which is that if something's gone on offer to somebody else, I think it's okay to know that.
It's on offer.
If that person then turns it down and they come back to you, job after 3 months, you know that you weren't the first choice.
But I've been told several times. I said, mate, what about it? And they'll come back and go, it's on offer. And that's fine, because equally
that's very useful.
I think a lot of the time, it's sometimes like if it's on offer, I think sometimes agents are like, well, I don't need to tell them that because I think there's a whole level of protection of managing of actors' mental states that people that consider themselves above us in the industry. That there's a hierarchy. There's a hierarchy of information, if not of anything else, and therefore you don't need to tell them that. It'll probably break their little hearts.
I think my agent knows that
you want to know
knowledge wherever it's there, and that even if it's heartbreaking news or just slightly disheartening, whatever, I'd just always rather know so I can get on with my life, basically.
An agent once told me that the only time an actor's truly happy is the 5 minutes after they get a job. In other words, assuming this all goes well and your agent calls and says, it was out on offer for 2 months, but that person is now passed, and lo and behold, it's come to you, and you're like, yes, and you celebrate for 5 minutes. His kind of worldview was, and this isn't to say that I agree with it, was that actors are only truly happy in the 5 minutes after they get that phone call. And then in his version of the world, that's when the self-doubt kicks in. Do you recognize any of that in yourself? And whether you don't, what happens in the kind of 5 minutes after the 5 minutes, if you know what I mean? What are your, the initial excitement dies down, what are the thought processes then?
Well, I always think that time when I did National early this year, I'd got the part a month before rehearsal started, and it was this golden month where I just got to sit around imagining how this was going to change the face of British theatre, and I was going to be, it would be the best performance anybody had ever done, and so on and so on. And so I think you definitely, the further away you are from beginning, the more you can indulge in all of that. Then you have to start thinking about actually doing some work and learning the lines, and then it gets really practical, and then you're in rehearsals and it's a real thing and not an imaginary thing, which is better in loads of ways, but also you have to let go of your kind of ego centric hopes and dreams and just do the job. And so I don't know, I'd say that I stay buoyant for longer than that 5 minutes, but I understand that the kind of fantasy element is you just get just after you got the job where you're like, this is going to be incredible, and then you have to come back down to earth. And I think that can be as dangerous in a way for me and my brain, going completely crazy about how amazing something's going to be. I think that can be quite problematic too, because then you do the job and you can end up feeling like disappointed or something, that you're not spending every day literally skipping down the road feeling like a legend. You're just a normal person doing a job, and a really brilliant one. So I did try to apply that actually with Machinal, was to get off cloud nine kind of as quickly as I could and start treating it like a practical thing, and doing voice warm-ups every day, and not just sitting around daydreaming about what my costumes were going to be like, to turn it into work.
Do you get nervous then coming towards the end of that process and before it goes in front of an audience? Do you get anxious about that? Have you ever suffered from any kind of stage fright?
Luckily, never suffered from stage fright. I definitely find that, for example, on a lunch break towards the end of a rehearsal process, I can sort of spiral. That's the moment where you're not doing anything and you can start going, oh, that bit's really not ready yet, and I don't know what I'm doing there, and oh, I'm going to have to do this in front of people, the press are going to be there, and I wonder what the reviews will say, and so on and so on. And actually, when I'm rehearsing, I forget all about it. So I think staying with the work outside of it, and just knowing that if you keep doing the work or whatever you want to call it, that's all you can do really. And also that even when you're playing a lead, you're not alone. So even if you have a complete disaster, somebody else is going to pick up the pieces and keep things moving. And so I get a lot of, I guess, comfort from being on stage with other actors. I think doing a one person play is probably the most frightening thing I can imagine, because you wouldn't have your fellow actors to support you and, you know, get you through a difficult moment.
Yeah. I can't think about being on stage alone without thinking about the one time that I delivered the last line of the play as the first line.
You just have to start again.
No, I was preset. This is the problem of being preset, and I'm not getting into the detail, but I stood up after when the light cue happened. I stood up into my light and started the open monologue of the play, and there was no other actor due on stage for another 5 minutes. And I also finished the play with a monologue imaginatively in the same space. And rather than say the opening line, I said the very similar but but significantly different final line of the play.
Just have to be like, oh, that's the end, guys.
I'm convinced there was a moment where certainly if not in the lighting box, in my head, it felt like that was the most appropriate thing to do, was just go to blackout.
And everyone would be like, wow, that's really avant-garde. We paid 20 quid to sit here for 4 minutes.
Let's not get into that. I mean,
I love stuff like that. I absolutely love actors having to save themselves or each other. It's just my favorite. It's the thing about it being live, and there's nothing I enjoy more, not from a sadistic point of view at all, because I feel so sorry for people. When you watch a play where you can tell that something live is happening, it doesn't normally happen.
I love,
because you suddenly see people work together in the most imaginative, amazing way and support each other.
Yeah, but
it's wonderful.
The sick guy inside me, it really likes it when it doesn't work. So my favorite story of all time, is a friend of mine was doing Under Milkwood, and he was really hungover. He's your man, Nameless, and he jumped in the middle of a monologue, jumped from Act One into Act Two, And so everyone, stage manager, was like, what the fuck are we going to do? And so there was an executive call, the wrong executive call, made that they would just jump to the queue. So the pages and, you know, the lighting box flip to whatever it was in Act Two. And they went to the lighting queue at the end of his monologue. And therefore they skipped out, like, you know, a good significant part of the play. But the best part of this story is that the entire family of one of the actors who was only in the section that he'd skipped over had traveled cross country several hundred miles, like 16 of them.
No, that's not fair.
To be there.
To go back at the end and be like, go back to Act One and do this little bit.
And so he was like, they were all like front row, he says, they might not have been, but like front row, he says, during the curtain call, it was the weirdest thing because they skipped the interval and it was a matinee and nobody knew quite what had happened.
But they knew something had happened.
Yeah, they knew that their daughter was not on stage, their sister, their whatever.
That is unbelievable.
Same actor was on a bicycle in the same production on a bicycle stand cycling, and the bicycle stand broke, and he cycled into the front row. I mean, I just think when theatre goes wrong,
we love live theatre. It's so exciting.
It's glorious.
Stuff like that can happen, and sometimes it does. I did a play a few years ago where someone told me the story, which I can't remember if it's something they were in or if this is just an urban legend. So you have to let me know if you've heard it.
Okay.
But they were in a production of The Seagull, and at the very end, the doctor comes onto the stage. You know, you hear the gunshot, and he came on the stage and went, Konstantin has shat himself. And the curtain came down. And the curtain came down, and all the actors were literally lying on the floor laughing. Of like, we've just told this whole story for a guy to shit himself at the end.
That's brilliant. And they all were secretly really angry about it as well, because there's nothing like putting in 2 hours or 3 hours of work.
3 hours of work with all the like, oh, we've seen a gun, what's going to happen? No, it just, I like that so much.
Yeah. So you said earlier you don't read interviews, but you mentioned, you were thinking anxiety of like, wonder what the reviews will be, but do you read reviews then?
Well, yeah, but I pretend even to myself that I'm someone that wouldn't read them, but I have to say I've always cracked in the end. And the reason I allow myself to is because I think you normally have like a fair idea of how you feel about the work that you're doing. Yep. And you feel about the production. So I'd like to think that if I was in something that got really, really terrible reviews, and, you know, I've definitely read like mediocre reviews, but I've never quite had to deal with the like really, really terrible one, that I would at least still be able to hold on to the faith that I had in the work we were doing. Obviously, I won't know until that moment, and then I might stop reading reviews. But I do think it's better not to. It's that the thing that bothers me is that, like, when we were doing Machinelle, and I thought, I'm not going to read them. And I held off for a tiny bit. But I found it so difficult. Whoever I spoke to and whoever's face I looked into, I felt like I could see in their eyes the number of stars we'd been given by Michael Billington or something. And like, if somebody smiled at me, I'd be like, are they smiling at me a bit sadly? Like, I'm so sorry.
Sadness in their eyes was apparent.
Sadness in their eyes. Or are they smiling at me like, amazing, everyone loved it.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'll just save myself the mind reading and read them. And it didn't. And yeah, I found it fine, to be honest. Things can stick in your mind that are unhelpful. And I think it's really important, if you do read something, to not, you have to be rigorous then in your performance of like, I'm not changing anything.
No, you mustn't.
You if you know that you're doing that, then you should never read one again. But I think that, yeah, I suppose I do feel like they are an opinion. They're often the opinion of someone who's well respected and knows a lot about the theatre, but it's still somebody's opinion. And all you can do is, I guess, accept it and go, you know, that's your opinion, and my opinion is this, and the director's opinion is this. And yeah, but I think, okay, particularly the director, you know, I have a lot of faith in, if you're working with a good director,
you have to.
And if they have faith in what you're doing, then you're probably on the right track.
So you successfully passed stage one of that question. Stage two is, have you ever Googled yourself?
Oh, yes, I have.
Of course.
And it's something that I have not allowed myself to do since, because it is a horrible thing to do.
Did you learn anything new about yourself? Did you find anything out that you didn't previously know?
I learned how wrong the internet is about so many things.
Right.
And where you want to be like, who should I call to say that's wrong and that's wrong? And
call the guys at the internet. Call the internet head office.
Guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, it made me really worried. I was like, do people think I've lied? People that know me, do they think I've lied about this stuff? Like, do they think I've just made up all these different things about myself and told them to people in interviews? And I haven't. But you just have to be like, anybody that really knows me would know I wouldn't do that, and probably has the sense to know that people make stuff up and people guess information, private information about you, and for anything from like your siblings to your age to whatever, they just kind of write whatever. So that was the thing that I learned, was don't do that, because you'll only find terrible things that you wish you hadn't seen. People can just say whatever they want, and that is sort of terrifying, and particularly with interviews, the ease with which you can be misquoted is astonishing. And it makes you realize why people do really boring, safe interviews, because that's the only way to have any control over what
say
people say that you've said. And even if somebody asks you a kind of leading question and you go, yeah, then they can kind of rephrase it in the interview as if you've said the thing that they suggested, even if you weren't really agreeing with it. So I know it's sort of a minefield. And I think the only answer is to not really care that if someone who doesn't know you has some wrong information about you or thinks you said something differently to how you said it, that's not the end of the world. Like,
doesn't
they
really
probably don't care.
Who
they
cares?
Probably don't care that much, and you probably don't care that much like this. Changing nobody's life.
I'm on the record at my first ever interview years ago. I was assistant director on a play 20 years ago. And I did an interview for a local paper in Northern Ireland. And I said, I don't think theatre should just be for the well off. And they published, I think theatre should just be for the well off. And to this day, I use that every time I have an interview. I remind myself of that. I just remind myself to be very, very clear.
Yeah.
I mean, that's in print somewhere. My mother has that in a scrapbook. I think theatre should just be for the well-off.
I think
it's terrifying.
For rich people. Thanks. You are alone in that view. I mean, yeah. So I think it's one of the reasons I stopped reading things, because even just tiny, tiny misquotes, I would obsess over and think, why did they write that? And how does that make me come across?
Yeah.
And also, I think whenever you're talking about yourself, which I know I'm doing now, but especially in print, it somehow can sound like you think everyone should care loads about what you have to say or to say about yourself.
Yep.
Obviously, there's the complex thing of the very fact that you're doing an interview means someone has asked you to say some things about yourself. But I think you also have to do them with a sense of awareness that you're not, you know, this isn't kind of your interview isn't going to change the world, or and people shouldn't be kind of falling over themselves to get to the magazine rack to see what Emily Barrington has to say about something. And it's very hard for it not to sound like that. And so I've never kind of got comfortable with that.
So in a world where, you know, there are many more media outlets for actors to be interviewed in, magazines, websites, podcasts, TV shows, all that carry on, and where PR and publicists and publicity have become a bigger part of the industry in the UK, how important do you think talent is? How important do you think public persona is? And how important do you think luck is? Like, if there's a kind of a ratio of things that are important,
and
let's say those are three pretty big parts of the industry today, whether we like it or whether we don't. In your experience, what do you think? Which of those do you think is most important?
The most
luck,
important?
Talent, well, or what are we going to call it?
PR stuff.
Or, yeah, what would that
persona,
be?
Persona,
like?
Public persona is kind of a good way to put it.
Yeah,
I suppose I think luck is probably the main thing, and that can cover all sorts of things, from the whole being in the right place at the right time, to, you know, the fact that if I auditioned for Guildhall a different year, I might not have got in, depending on who else was there.
Yep.
But also the luck of whether you happen to be born with certain attributes that a certain casting director is looking for in that moment.
Or
your height. Yes, exactly. In an era that where people are wanting to cast someone who sounds like you or looks like you or whatever. And so I think that's, you know, and some of that is tied in with privilege and that whole conversation that, you know, unfortunately, all of that, I guess, comes under, even though it's a horrible way to put it, but luck. And also, luckily, that is all changing. And hopefully talent is becoming increasingly important. And I do also think that talent is important, because you can be as lucky as you want and get in as many amazing rooms as you want, but you also, I guess, have to deliver, and people have to want to work with you. And they might want to work with you because of your level of fame and your public persona. They might want to work with you because of how you sound or look or what height you are. But I guess maybe this is just hopeful, but I always hope that kind of at some point talent is important too, and also your work ethic, which are tie in with talent, which is like whether you can apply your ability to actually doing something. That there are the people I like to work with the most are the ones that care about those things and that are really excited about the ideas you have, more than whether you've ever been on the cover of a magazine or something.
Okay, so
but it's hard because I kind of subscribe to all of those things, and you want it to just be talent, but it's not.
So do you believe in big breaks then?
Not in a kind of fate style way of like your big break will come. I think that some people get a job that takes them from relative obscurity in terms of their persona to doing a really high profile job that loads of people see and loads of people want to cast them as a result of. But if any, I often think that the actors I know that have careers that I really admire are people that have every job they've done, or not even every job they've done, but they've done a series of jobs where they make progress in a different direction, whether that's because they work with somebody new or they do a very different type of performance or they expand their kind of creative, I don't know, abilities in a new way. And it gives them the confidence to do something else. And that's the kind of career I've always been more interested in, partly because it's way more likely. And you're not relying on fate kind of handing you magically some incredible job. But also it just feels like a more realistic way to build a career, that if you think about other careers, that tends to be how they go. Other people get a job, they work really hard, they maybe get on really well with somebody, they, you know, progress up the ladder. And I kind of, there's something about that that feels realistic in a reassuring way.
Yeah. So from the outside, let's say some of your Guildhall peers watching you get cast in a big international TV show co-production between an American company and a British company, it would be fair to say that some of them would be forgiven for thinking, God, that's Emily's had her big break.
They might, yeah.
And I guess at points during that process, it may even have felt to you like, oh, this is the big break. This is, you know, because everything's relative, I guess, as well, because I'm guessing now for you to feel like you're having a big break again, it would have to feel bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you could have felt like you were having your big break coming out of drama school, like, I'm working at the Alma, I've got a job.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
So,
just like,
so everything's
doing, yeah.
Everything kind of seems relative, I guess. But does then the realization that you have to go back to auditioning, is that harder after having had a what people might consider a big break, even if you didn't yourself, is you know, going back to auditioning after a big show more difficult than before? Do you feel more unemployed or, you know, more powerless because you felt like you might have had power for a change?
Yeah, I think there is something in that, which is that after I got that first job at the Almeida and I left Guildhall and did this play, and I remember it was got really good reviews, and I kind of thought, oh God, it's just going to be so great from now on. You know, I probably won't have to audition for stuff anymore.
Yeah.
And then I just could not get a job for, I don't know how long it was after. I mean, it was probably 6 months or something, which isn't later learned is not very long, but at the time it felt long, and it was a real back down to earth. A job is just a job. It's amazing while it lasts. Make the most of it, because you can feel very much like you're back at square one. You're not necessarily, but it can feel like that. And I remember bumping into somebody I knew, and they said to me in that time, they'd known I'd gone to see that play, and they said to me, what, you're not working? And I thought, oh no, I know you mean that as a compliment, but I know. I felt like I'd had a very long fall from a dizzy height that I'd taken myself to. So I try really hard not to do that. But inevitably, you know, when Humans came out and it was this smash hit success, like the biggest ratings Channel 4 had had in 20 years for a drama. And again, you have that creeping little voice coming in and going, oh, it's going to be so easy from now. Every job you want will just be laid out on a platter. And actually, after that first series, I had another. It's funny, it quite often seems to happen after a moment where you maybe look very successful, that's when things can end up feeling very quiet, that for whatever reason, whether it's timing or luck, or you're strategically trying to like do something a bit different, so you're saying no to some stuff, or you're just not getting offers, it happens again and again. And so I always tell myself, I'm not gonna wind myself up and think this is it, this is the life-changing moment, but it's hard not to do, because you want it to make things easier. You want a job to mean not just 3 months of amazing work. You want it to mean, oh, I won't have to do quite so many auditions next year. But in reality, I guess you have to accept that it may mean that, or it may make no difference whatsoever.
So you hinted at 6 months there. You didn't hint, you said 6 months
yeah.
after the Almeida. What's the longest you've gone without employment as an actor?
Well, between the first and second series of Humans, where we were optioned for another series. So I did, I guess it's cheating because I knew I had another job coming around, but that was a year and I didn't work. I didn't do anything else year.
What? I'm going to do what your friend did. You weren't working?
You weren't working?
What?
I know. And
that
I
is
guess
crazy.
It's, to, I, and again, I'd be sort of being disingenuous if I said I was also trying to be selective about what I did.
Yeah, of course.
But any of the things I really wanted to do didn't come off for obviously a million reasons. And so...
But you felt always like one might. So you weren't saying no thinking, I'm quite happy not to work for a year. You were saying something else will come up.
Yeah. And I think that was, you know, it was the right call. And I had a bit of confidence because I knew something was coming back round. So financially, I knew it'd be okay. And I'd be doing something, again, that I loved. But I remember really finding that very difficult and thinking this is kind of the absolute epitome of people saying, oh my God, it's going so well for you. And me thinking, I'm actually very frustrated and a bit disillusioned. And then you have another year where you haven't been in a big exciting show and actually like everything seems to, well, not everything, but loads of things seem to come off and work really well. So
it's like the acting equivalent of feeling lonely in a room full of people. It's feeling unemployed or feeling, you know, worthless or feeling like unsuccessful.
Yeah. I remember Hayley Atwell came to speak to us at Guildhall because she'd gone there. She did a Q&A and she talked about being on the red carpet for Captain America and not knowing how she was going to pay her mortgage because she hadn't worked since they'd made it or something. And I remember thinking, no, that's not. I just thought, that's not possible. That's just not, it can't be possible.
That's horrific.
It is possible. And it happens all the time. Because normally the kind of glamorous side of things happens, obviously, months after you've made the film or the series.
Yeah.
So you're so far away from making that piece of work. And you are so far away.
The money's gone.
The money is
all the tax bill looms. You know,
you're in a completely different headspace. You also then have to have conversations with your fellow colleagues of like, what are you up to?
And oh, Jesus, nothing worse.
It's really, they're the only people where you can't lie and be like, well, I've just wrapped on this film.
Yeah.
They're like, no, I was on that too. And it was 6 months ago.
Yeah. And also you had really 2 days.
And they've been cut.
Yeah.
That was the kind of a challenging time, but it taught me so much in that year. I remember thinking, you know, I can't be someone that just sits around and waits for stuff to happen. I've got to start writing. I've got to start, you know, just doing other stuff that's not to do with acting. I started volunteering, which I still do now and get loads of joy from. And I decided to kind of keep learning and like start reading way more. And also, you know, financially, like really get on top of things and not just be somebody that like waits for all their money to run out and then panic. That it was quite a, it was a helpful year. And if I have a year like that again, I know that I'll be, well, I hope I'll be way better prepared for what that entails.
So,
If
then you're better prepared for being unemployed again, what ways of coping have you acquired? Like what will you go, if that happens again, what are the things that you've learned that will make it easier?
Well, doing some stuff that's not about acting. I think it's very tempting to feel like you have to spend all day every day making yourself into an actor because no one's paying you to do it, and reading stuff and making sure you get to the theatre, and all that's great and I think very valuable, but I think you need some things that are not a means to an end and that are not about your career. So that's where I actually think volunteering is great. Not to sound holier than thou, but it's something about, you know, acting can be such a self-focused career where you're constantly thinking about yourself and how people view you. Doing something where your focus is going out onto somebody else or something else or a cause that is, it can help put things in perspective if you don't get a job, but you're doing something that is, you're not being paid for, but is extremely meaningful in another way and makes you feel interested and alert and kind of in tune with the world around you or your community or something, I find really, is fantastic. So I joined the Good Gym, which is a really brilliant organization that connects people who like running with isolated people in their community. So perhaps elderly people who don't have any relatives nearby. And the idea is you run to their house. So they set you up with someone who's a kind of a good running distance away. And then have a cup of tea, and they're called your coach. Like, they inspire you to do your run, even if it's raining or whatever.
Oh.
And yeah, and then you have a cup of tea, a bit sweaty on the sofa. But
I was thinking that. Our spark on the sofa alert.
I know. I think you've got to be careful with what you take with you and make sure you've got things to sit on if you've really
bring a reusable plastic bag.
Bring something, or take off your little like running fleece and sit on that. And yeah, have a cup of tea, have a lovely chat, and then you can run home, or I quite often get the bus home because I'm tired by then. So yeah, it's great. And something about it that feels very, it's not one-sided. You know, you've both really benefit, and the person I visit, we've got really great friendship, and I've been visiting her for 2 years now, and yeah, it's a big part of my life.
That's great.
And yeah, really, it just, because that's someone that they don't care if I didn't get the audition that I went in for on Friday. I mean, they might if I told them about it, but it's just out of the acting bubble.
Yeah.
Which I love. So I'd say that is my number one thing.
So getting back into the acting bubble then, one of the things that we spoke about kind of after the Equity chat was social media.
Yeah.
And I went to contact you in social media about something and then went, hold on, and then searched for you again on Twitter and was like, what? Which
She's
quite often
there.
Happens now with actors. Like, I must admit, I went through a period about maybe 18 months ago where I unfollowed every single actor, including friends that I followed on Twitter, because I found actually that other actors were the people that were making me feel depressed.
Yeah, it's really tough, isn't it?
And so you're off everything, or what's the deal, and how
Instagram.
Did that come about?
I left Facebook a few years ago and then Twitter last summer. And I think, I don't know, it wasn't a kind of major decision, and it's not that I won't go back on it. I probably will at some point, but I just noticed that my anxiety levels when I'd been on Twitter or was looking at it were kind of skyrocketing, partly because I was, every time I tweeted anything, a bit like with reading back interviews, I'd then spend 2 hours going, was that stupid? Was that, did I sound like I was showing off?
Why is no one like that?
Yeah, well, like, what have I offended the whole universe? And like, what can I do? Shall I delete it? Will that look weirder? And so I just thought, why am I putting myself through this for something that, as far as I can see, has fairly minimal impact? I think that there are ways in which it's great. And for actors, I think there's ways in which it's great, particularly if you're promoting something or you're, I don't know, if you're doing something that like could do with some social media like hype behind it, then that's great. And yeah, I would happily rejoin if I had a
but
kind
do you
of
think
purpose.
Do you think not being on Twitter has harmed you in any way professionally?
No, I think it's only benefited me emotionally.
Right.
I think there could, I mean,
I think that's the fear. I think people have this fear
about
that they'll be invisible.
Yeah. That they'll be invisible totally.
That,
yeah,
and that other people will be visible, and therefore the people who are visible will get the meetings, and they'll be,
for sure.
You know, I think that's the thing, is that I think personally anyway, sometimes you feel like I might cease to exist in this industry if I'm unemployed and also not on Twitter. That means I don't exist.
I always think though that I completely understand that, but I think that there's way more of me looking out at other people then there are, like, I'm the one looking at casting directors' profiles. They're probably not looking at mine, because if they want to see me or meet with me, I guess I just, to a degree, have to just trust that they will. There is always a fear, and I always hate those rumours that go around of, like, did that person get cast because they have 50,000 Twitter followers?
Yeah.
And I suppose I always just think, well, if that's how things get cast, I don't know if I can bring myself to be part of that kind of race, and that that seems like such a terrible thing if it were true, that if that literally the kind of numbers on a Twitter profile, that I'd rather not be playing the game in a way. And I don't know if that is affect me or not, whether I'll be shooting myself in the foot, but I would certainly, I guess I would consider rejoining if someone could tell me it was definitely going to help me. I think it was, I just began to notice that it didn't feel worth it for the hassle I felt. Not that I was getting hassle, but just the, I don't know, the day-to-day stress of it, and the comparison it would make me do, and also that was somehow sometimes the place I'd hear about a job I hadn't got because somebody had tweeted about getting it, and I'd think, this isn't, why don't I just remove myself from this system and stop myself having to worry about whether what I've tweeted will make me look stupid to a director who's followed me on Twitter or whatever. Yeah. Like, yeah. Why don't I just be, because also I love that whole thing of how, you know, in the past actors were allowed to be a bit more mysterious and could therefore maybe transform a bit more easily. That I always thought, if I'm kind of putting who I am out into the world, how will somebody believe me as something else? And I know people can, but I always found that a bit tricky.
Do you find it difficult to be friends with other actors? I mean, do you find it, say, difficult? Obviously, we have close friends and they are whatever they are, whether they're actors or not, and our closest friends, that it really isn't something that you consider, I think. But in terms of your extended friendship group, I mean, I mentioned just having unfollowed people because I found that I just wasn't enjoying other people's successes, if I'm totally honest, or rather how they were being sold or being spun. I didn't really enjoy so much. I wonder, do you find it difficult to celebrate friends' successes? Do you find yourself giving in to jealousy or comparison, if you want to put a kind of more, slightly more positive spin on it? Do those things have an impact on relationships?
I think I definitely feel all those things, and I definitely have major pangs of jealousy or comparison now and again, which I think can also exist in like a really complicated way with being really happy for somebody that, you know, it's not, I think there's sort of a scale where sometimes I'm like 90% happy and 10% jealous, and sometimes it's the other way around. And sometimes even the happy bit can't really exist yet, because especially if it was something I also auditioned for. But so many of my friends are actors that I've actually found that what is what's really helpful is the actors that I have stayed very good friends with are naturally uncompetitive. So you're not having those conversations where we're like talking about work, but really we're just kind of sussing each other out and working out who's doing better or whatever. Like, people like that I really would struggle to be friends with. But also, most of my friends who are actors, they are people who don't get much joy from talking about the business side of things, which is a joy that, you know, I find kind of acting business chat quite difficult and it's not the thing that makes me love being an actor. That's the creative side of things. And there are people that you feel you've got really kind of stuck into are like, oh yeah, do you have American representation and who are they and what do you think of them and do you have PR, and you think, oh my god, this isn't what I think of when I think about,
I'm not relaxed right now.
Like, I feel like I'm being put on the spot, and and every answer might be being judged as to whether it's better or worse than what you do. So that kind of thing, I wouldn't have any time for. But all my actor friends, I think, are probably, you know, we've stayed friends because we're not like that. And if anything, we can maybe help to alleviate some pressure from each other and reassure and support and also allow people a bit of space to feel a bit jealous or a bit comparison-y or whatever, that's really human. And I would never expect someone to kind of, if I told an actor friend about a great new job, I would never expect them to kind of hit the ceiling with joy immediately. That would be unfair.
And you probably guard how you tell them as well and pick your moment. So what about other friends, do you think being an actor has an effect on personal relationships beyond that? Like, I mean, in terms of just, I suppose, explaining that the missing of other people's important moments, be it like someone's wedding or someone's hen do, or perhaps even, you know, not being there for family events or not being available, not being able to commit to things early on.
Do you find that
has an impact on relationships, you know, in terms of people including you in things or assuming that you won't be able to take part, or, you know?
I think I definitely have found that very hard over the years of missing major things. And I try really hard not to. And I used to kind of, if I got an audition for the next day and it was someone's birthday dinner that night, I would just be like, I'm sorry, I can't come, I have to work on this audition. Whereas I've tried to find ways now where, more than anything, because it would then make me resent the audition so much if I didn't get it and I'd missed a really important event, that trying to be a bit more reasonable and go, you know, I'll do some work now and then go to this for a bit and then come home. So I don't miss as many things as I used to. But sometimes it's inevitable. If you have to work, if you're doing a play, you can't get a Saturday off for someone's wedding.
Can't you just get like an understudy to do it?
But that would be great.
That's always the one.
Yeah.
Can you just
get your understudy on? You think, no, that's really not allowed.
That's not why they're there. Even if I have one.
Broken legs. It's like, yeah. Even if I have one. So, no, that is tough. I think I've been quite lucky in people being understanding. But I can also tell that sometimes the trickiest bit is if you're explaining to people that you have to miss something and it's for a job that sounds really amazing and exciting, it's easy for people to get their heads around, obviously, because they're like, oh, I understand that that's unmissable.
Yes.
If it's something that doesn't sound particularly glamorous or people don't know what it is, then you feel like you have to do a bit more justifying of like, I know this doesn't sound important, but it is actually, and I have to be there and your thing's important too. And it is challenging. And I think that my strategy is to be so understanding if anybody ever misses anything of mine. I'm literally like begging people not to come to my birthday party, being like, it's too much trouble, even if you have a cold, if your cat's not very well, please don't come, please, I'll understand.
So listen, like, if you want to invite me this year, I guarantee I won't come. And
well,
you know,
it was last Friday,
friends.
So
happy birthday. Happy birthday. Sorry I couldn't make it, I was so busy.
I really understand,
and also there was the fact that you didn't invite me.
So
we're nearly there. I think we've done a lot, and we've talked about, as we always do, without being negative, I hope, we've talked about all of the things that are difficult, the various things, and they may seem, I suppose, people outside the industry, petty at points, but I think taken together, it's a fairly, you know, it can be a fairly overwhelming picture of negatives, or I don't know what the right word is, but you know what I mean.
So there's a lot of challenges.
Challenges. That's the word.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah, good.
A lot of challenges.
But have they ever got to the point where you've considered throwing in the towel and saying, you know what, I'm going back to a career in geography, or I'm going to go back into politics.
I am going to be a geographer.
Park ranger.
Luckily,
I met a park ranger last night who'd done a geography degree, and I thought, there's the reason to be.
That's what I could have done.
You know what I mean?
Oh, I wish I'd known. No, yeah. You know what? I really recommend a geography degree to anybody. I definitely have considered whether I can sustain it and keep facing those challenges. And the way I deal with that is I just say to myself, right, well, no one's making you be an actor. You have a choice. What do you want to do then? And sometimes I even make myself decide on other jobs I would like to have and say, okay, well, why don't you look into how you would become that? And inevitably, so far, the pull to stay being an actor, even when it's really hard, has always been stronger. But I find that doing that test on myself very helpful, partly because it's really empowering in that it's me saying to myself, you don't have to do this. You are not trapped in doing this forever. Oh, sorry, someone's just come in. Just doing an interview. I'll start that again. Real life goes on. So I guess that what I was saying was that I set myself the little test of whether there's something else I'd rather do, whether I should follow another path. And I just say to myself, right, Emily, if it's that bad, don't do it then.
Yeah.
And I say, no, Emily, I want to do it. I mean, I don't say it out loud using my
Emily,
name, but
how much of that is about, I have this feeling quite a lot as I get older, that acting has ruined me for any potential that I may have had to have a full-time job.
And transferable skills. We've got so many transferable skills.
One of my transferable skills is not working 5 days a week, 48 weeks of the year, right?
I think we could surprise ourselves.
I always think like that sounds like really good fun. Then you think, okay, but you don't get to spend as much time with your wife. You don't get to take your dog.
Yeah.
For a while. Like it's that classic thing.
Can't
I keep
be
repeating.
A friend for a coffee on a Tuesday.
You know what I mean? Yeah. There are worse things than being an unemployed actor if you can manage the psychological aspects of it.
Yes, and the financial side of it.
There are definitely worse things than being an unemployed actor. So,
I agree. I totally agree. And I often, when I'm on the sofa feeling sorry for myself, I think, I'll get a grip. You know, you could be like slaving away in some sort of really difficult job right now, feeling really stressed. You're on the sofa. It's okay.
It's, like, it's going to be okay.
Get over yourself.
So what's the best part of the job? Turning it around to positives. What's the best thing? The thing that keeps you coming back? The thing that stops you going and being a park ranger?
Yes. Apart from that, I wouldn't know how to do that.
It's on your Wikipedia page. I'm going to put it there tonight.
Please do. I think the other people. I think park rangers it's kind of a solitary career.
Okay.
No, but genuinely, the other people. I think that I really love working as part of a cast. I love the rehearsal process. I love working with other actors, and I think it's that as much as anything. Also getting your hands on a great story, and you know, and you read a script and you just think, this is amazing. I've loved just reading it. Imagine if I get to turn it into something live and real. I just like it so much. So yeah, on those days where I feel really kind of like, is this too tough? Is the instability too difficult? You get something through that it catches your imagination, and that's sort of enough to spur you on to keep going.
I like it. Other people is good. A good reason to do this job.
I mean, I understand other people also work with other people. But I think a lot of actors offer something really amazing when you work with them. Some don't. Some are dreadful.
One of the things is it's people find, and it sounds fucking wanky, but people said all the time is they found their tribe. They knew whenever they did the play at 17 or at 11 or 22, whatever it was, that they felt like, oh, these are my people. And that gets you through a hell of a lot of the way, I think, gets you help, you know, sweetens the rest of the deal a little bit.
It really does.
We're coming towards the end. You'll recognize these questions if you've heard the podcast before.
Yes.
Do you consider yourself successful?
Oh, I don't know, because I hate the word successful. I think it's also relative. And
we'll get to
day
that.
To day.
We'll get to that.
Yeah. I honestly can't answer it. I think it's something that if I said yes, that would feel disingenuous. And if I said no, it would also feel disingenuous.
Okay. So your younger self, let's go back to the person who graduates from a geography degree and then decides they want to go to drama school. If that young woman was handed your CV or your spotlight page or whatever it is, and maybe even read some of the interviews that that have embarrassed you over the years, would she think, God, I'm successful?
Oh, she would be thrilled, because she never thought she was going to get a single job. And she would definitely be looking at the CV going, wow, you know, that's pretty great.
So the natural question then is you've already said it, that success is relative, right? And how do you define success now in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable about, defining whether or not you fit into that?
Yeah, well, the reason I feel uncomfortable is because I do think it's relative. And I think whatever stage you got to, you know, you could be nominated for an Oscar and feel unsuccessful because you didn't win. And I think that's where I really struggle with it, because I know it's not, I think it's such an unsafe thing to be chasing after, because the second you think you've got hold of it, it sort of disappears and is another 10 feet further away from you.
Yep.
So I try, and I'd be lying if I said I always succeed, to, if I'm doing enough of what I enjoy, and if I am, doing enough of kind of acting work that allows me to pay for at least some of my life and, you know, all that kind of thing, then that feels successful. And I also, you know, I look at friends that have done much less kind of high profile work, but I think of them as very successful because they've made a life that works for them with their acting careers. So that's what I'm always looking for, is like, how do you make your life and what you want from life, that's not just a career, that's like all the rich things that you want, how do you make that work in that career? And if you've kind of keep managing to find that, then that feels like success. Equally, you know, I'll open the Evening Standard magazine and go, that person's successful because they're in this magazine. So I have to keep checking in with myself about what I think it really is.
What's the best advice you've ever been given? If you've ever been given good advice at all, and that, you know,
Yeah, I have.
So what are the things that help you either as a performer or as a human being to survive this industry or to be a better actor or whatever? What are the nuggets that stick with you?
So Dominic West came and did a speech at our graduation at Guildhall, and he said a phrase which was, hold on tightly, let go lightly, which obviously is lovely because it rhymes, but also I often think of that in terms of auditions and press nights and high pressure moments where you think, hold on tightly, as in, you know, this does mean something, so work really hard and really go for it and invest and put yourself in there, and then let go lightly and let go of it and let it be whatever it is and try and move on from it. It's really hard to do, but I often have that in my mind if I'm not doing the letting go bit very well, which is the bit I find hardest. And particularly if you've had like a rubbish day where you're terrible in rehearsals or you really screwed up an audition, it's so important to just
let go
of it, because you sitting at home thinking about it isn't going to change anything. So that's been really good advice. And then actually, yeah, the advice that I was given about keeping your failures and your successes and how you react to them kind of to a degree in moderation, I've also found very helpful, that if every time you get a job or a recall you drink 10 bottles of champagne, then when you don't get something, I then feel like I have to do the kind of negative equivalent, which I don't know what that is.
Yeah,
like,
no, I know what you mean. You have to balance it.
That you somehow have to feel as terrible as you would feel good if you got it. And so like bringing those things somewhere towards the middle has been quite helpful.
Interestingly, it came up in the equity thing about Lerner mentioned the whole thing about a couple of years ago now, I'd said, we always celebrate. In our house, we celebrate every little success. We've stopped doing that, I think, just partly because we've stopped registering them as much. I think it wasn't design.
So it's probably just become a more normal part of life.
Yeah.
Like it's a yes or it's a no.
And, yeah, exactly. That's a really healthy thing to kind of think about. If you could go back and offer your younger self advice, so let's go back again to that young woman coming out of Guildhall, say. If you could go back and offer her some advice to help make the intervening years pass a little bit more smoothly, with less obstacles and with less anxiety, maybe, what advice might you offer her?
Well, I mean, if I could go all the way back to the innkeeper's wife, then I would say to her, demand your own line. Say half the words, please. But then if I could skip forward to go to, the person leaving Guildhall, I think it's something along the lines of, so little of this is to do with you. Does that make sense? That it's like, so little of what happens is in your control. So if you try and control every single moment and like nail every single moment and work yourself kind of to the bone on every audition, you're expending a lot of energy that actually a lot of it doesn't have anything to do with you. So like put the responsibility and everything into somebody else's hands and just do an amount that you feel good about. I think it would be that I know in some ways that sounds kind of disempowering because you're handing over the power to other people, but I actually find acknowledging that that's how it works quite relaxing, in a way that you can't make yourself get a job. You can only offer your work and see what happens.
Penultimate question, which kind of jumps off your first answer to that a little bit, which is, if you were in charge for a day and you could make changes that would be lasting and immediate, what changes would you make, or what would be at the top of the list of changes that you might make to our industry?
I would definitely find a way that enabled casting directors to give everybody a yes or a no, or at least an update, something where 2 weeks down the line, you would hear something, even if it was, we haven't made a decision yet. I don't know what that would take. And I'd love to hear from anyone that knows that, like, what facilities are required to make that happen, because I definitely don't think it's just people not giving shit. I think that, you know, there's challenges for everybody involved. So that would be the first thing. And also, I think the flip side of that, which is that giving actors more time to prepare for auditions, that's often one of the things I find most challenging in terms of my own mental health, is when you get something 24 hours in advance. And again, I know there's a million reasons why, and people aren't just like sitting on the script refusing to send it to you. But those are the days where I get super stressed. I cancel loads of stuff.
Yeah.
I often do not very good work because all I'm trying to do is learn the lines and cram them in my head. And it's the whole 24 hours is really unsatisfactory, and probably for the people in the room that I meet as well, because they're meeting someone super stressed who's just learnt the lines and doesn't really have any ideas to offer. So if there was a way to change that, I also think it's so kind of not a reflection of what acting is about, that, you know, knowing the lines is in many ways the least important bit. Having ideas and
it's like an
choices.
Acting test designed by someone from outside the industry. It's like, you know,
yeah,
whenever
it kind
you,
of is.
Yeah,
like,
it's like, oh, how do they learn their lines?
Yeah. And you know, I have so many friends that are dyslexic and find that impossible, who are fantastic actors. And I think, can people see that in those kind of meetings? Because all they're seeing is someone that struggled a bit more to learn lines. But if they got this job, they'd be incredible. So it feels kind of fairly unequal, that whole system. And again, I don't know what is happening 10 stages away from me getting the phone call that means...
Inequality, Emily, in the entertainment industry.
Well, and that would be the final thing. Is kind of continuing. Thank you for, the continuing changes towards where we can look for equality.
Yeah.
Intersectionally, with gender, with age. I'd love to see way more things happen with older actors. And I think that we're really sort of missing a trick there, because we live in such a youth-centric society.
Emily Barrington, last question. Are you in anything at the minute?
No.
Loves it. Listen, it has been an absolute pleasure. I'm sorry we ran over slightly. My apologies. We had a little tech issue. So I have thoroughly enjoyed our chat. I'm really glad we did it. I'm sorry we didn't do it sooner. And that's it for episode 7. Thanks to Emily for doing it. Thanks to you for listening, and in advance for sharing it with the people who you love, and for giving us a glowing rating and review on iTunes or wherever it is you listen to podcasts, should ratings and reviews be a thing. I'll be back in a week or two. Who knows how I feel in the intervening weeks will largely dictate when the next podcast appears. But until then, thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.